Khoonie, The Crimes of India is a thoroughly researched podcast that uses publicly available documents, reports, and books and associated media to provide listeners with a complete picture of the week's case. The following content is often graphic and regularly uncomfortable. Mentions of assault, bodily harm, and death may follow. Khoonie, The Crimes of India does not condone any actions mentioned in the episode. Minors are advised to exercise caution before proceeding. Thank you. Namaste, Namaskaram. Welcome to today's episode of Khoonie, The Crimes of India. I'm Sneha and I'm in Hyderabad, and I have with me on WhatsApp Aditi, who's in Lucknow. Hi, how's it raining, bro?
It was raining since forever. It just stopped this morning, which is a respite, for at least for our clothes, you know, which have not dried. So after 3 days, finally, we have some dried clothes. Also, we're recording on Navroz. So Navroz Mubarak to all our listeners. Yeah, I don't know if we have any Parsi listeners, but there you go.
If you listen to us, give us a shout out. So Aditi, will you tell our audience what we're doing today? I'm sure they already know, but like, dramatic effect.
Yes, we are starting a multi-parter on Veerappan.
Woohoo! Yeah, like lately we've been doing all kinds of weird and different things. So this is just another thing we're doing. We thought, okay, let's not do run-of-the-mill things. Let's do something different. We haven't found anybody else who've covered Veerappan, so why not?
Yeah. So how has this deep dive been for you, Sneha?
Enlightening. Yeah, not even kidding. I came to know so many things. Like, to me, for a large extent, Veerappan was just someone whose mustache people used to imitate here and there, like when you go to Karnataka and all. But
oh yeah, the legendary mustache, of course. How can I forget?
It is so iconic. Okay, it is so iconic. Like, I'm not going to give out any spoilers, but one of the people Veerappan kidnapped, that man recognized Veerappan only by looking at his mustache, because it happened in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Oh my God. I think the way to avoid detection by Veerappan should have been, like, he should have asked 3-4 of his men to grow a mustache just like him.
Ingenious. But I'm sure there are a couple of, like, we'll put up pictures of his generals or members of his gang. They all had those big mustaches. Oh, kind of cool.
Okay. Then it was a major stroke of luck, right, for this guy to have just recognized the right person. He selected the right mustache.
The thing is, like, imagine, okay, like, that guy just looks at you and he's pointing a rifle at you, and then, you know it's him. Like, who else can it be? Like, nobody else stares down a gun at your face if you're in those parts of the jungle.
Yeah.
Also, this guy is an obvious candidate for our Khoonie Hall of Infamy. I mean, it takes a special kind of talent to evade the police of 3 states for more than 2 decades. Like, more than 2 decades.
Yeah, or navigate the jungles of 3 states and smuggle all kinds of ivory, sandalwood, and lead an army of 200 people from the forest. That is insane.
Yeah, 200 people. Can you imagine? Like, at his biggest, there were 200 people in his gang. Wow. Yeah. So, right, I'm sure our audience is, like, eager to start. Let's just dive in. But before that, as usual, let me tell you guys the sources. The first book I read is called Veerappan, Chasing the Brigand by K. Vijay Kumar. So, Vijay Kumar was the chief of the Special Task Force of Tamil Nadu that was involved in Veerappan's death and capture during Operation Cocoon in 2004. Now, this book goes into great details about Veerappan's capture and also gives us, you know, insights into earlier failed police missions to capture him. But what I found about this book is it was very police-centric. In fact, Mr. Vijay Kumar himself has said in interviews that he has written it from a police perspective. Obviously, where else will he write it from?
Yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much of a police apology is this book?
7 to 8. Because half the time he keeps bragging about his career also. So.
Wow, that is high. That is high. Okay.
So the other book is called Veerappan's Prize Catch, Rajkumar by C. Dinakar. And this talks about the kidnapping of Rajkumar, which we will talk about in our second episode. But I thought I'll just list it out now. And the thing is, I couldn't really get my hands on the physical book or even on Kindle. So I managed to read it somehow on Google Books. And I really wouldn't want people to go through the hassle I did. I read it because you don't have to. And then there's the other Supreme Court judgment on Rajkumar's kidnapping. And that's it. Apart from that, a couple of articles here and there. But these are our three main sources.
So guys, this is going to be a long one. Grab your coffee / beer or popcorn and or whatever and get settled in.
Right. So Koosu Muniswamy Veerappan was born on 18th January 1952 and obviously, as we all know, is famously known as Veerappan.
Ah, like Madonna and Cher and Bono. Such elite company.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, I mean, you need to be that special to be only called by your given name, really. I mean, if you go out on a street, yeah, wearing a mask, of course, and call out Aditi or Sneha, legit, some minimum three girls will turn and look back at you, like minimum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You and I have the most common Indian names, probably.
Yeah, true. Anyway, so there was a myth, okay, there's a lot of myth surrounding his birthday, okay? Like the dates given to the police by a lot of people differed by almost 10 years. Dude, I don't know how this happens. Like 10 years?
A person of Veerappan's age, I'm pretty sure there were hardly any written records. I don't know if his birth was even documented, like there was a birth certificate or not. So Veerappan gave different dates to different people, I'm assuming, and those people then eventually gave the same dates to the police.
Yeah, probably. So Veerappan was born in a village called Gopinatham in Chamarajanagar district in Karnataka. Now, this place is in the border area of Karnataka and Tamil Nadu. And most importantly, and this is important for all the listeners and us and to the story, this village is nestled among thick shrub forest and mountainous ranges. Again, very important. Know this. So now in the after Veerappan era, this village has become like a small tourist attraction, and the Karnataka government has been trying really hard to encourage people to come visit this place. And they even made this 13 kilometers hike range, but then sadly COVID happened and fucked everything up. In fact, some of the migrant workers, they have said that they found it easier to get home walking through these forests. And they apparently told the press that 10-15 years ago, they couldn't even imagine walking through these forests for the fear of Veerappan. Damn.
Fuck you, 2020.
Seriously. Anyway, Veerappan was the second of four children. And we already told you where he was born and blah, 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 of the same geography, history, everything. Now, naturally, the villagers were quite comfortable with the forests and the hills around them. And the area was rich in natural resources, but like most tribal areas, was economically backward. And the government literally had little or no touch with the people there. So K. Vijay Kumar writes in his book that apparently, like the wild, wild west, every second family in the area had a crude firearm of some kind, almost usually unlicensed. And they were, most cases, muzzle loaders.
What is a muzzle loader?
Okay, so basically, I did my research, okay? I read up. They are a type of a rifle. And knowing this much is enough, okay? Like, these are basically, the families had these to protect themselves both from wild boars and wild animals, and sometimes government, like police and the gang members equally.
Yeah, so okay, so in the north, these things are known as kattas, but they're like pistols, not rifles.
Oh, okay, cool, cool. And I find it funny how Vijay Kumar calls this the wild, wild west. Anyway, so like in most places, the police turned a blind eye towards these unlicensed arms. Apparently, the police used to raid once in a while, and then these families used to hide everything or just try and get away with bribing the police. And most often than not, they should just like run away into the forest and police couldn't find them only. So this is the kind of environment where Veerappan grew up, and he was very comfortable with guns. And soon he turned out to be a talented shooter. There was a rumor that people saw him shoot monkeys as they swung from tree to tree. Yeah, and apparently he was doing this with a makeshift homemade muzzle loader. And this apparently was a great display of marksmanship. Clap hands, Aditi. Like, I'm imagining one small tiny boy shooting at monkeys which are swinging from like branches.
This would make for a great movie scene. You laugh, but I mean, the sheer cinematography of this scene would be breathtaking, I think. Just a little boy shooting at moving monkeys, it'd be great.
Right. So his first case, I mean, the first case against him was registered when he shot a wild boar. So he was just a boy, and we are not sure what his age was, must be around 10. Then when a forest officer came looking for him, he ran away into the forest and the officer could not keep up with him.
And the rest, as they say, is history, or I don't know, I think they say practice makes perfect. Both apply in this case. So his skills did not remain hidden for too long. As it always happens in cases like this, they caught the attention of a local poacher named Sevi Gounder. This guy had the backing of a local MLA. So he joined his gang and soon became a valuable member. Now there is another story about him. He is said to have killed his first elephant at the age of 10. Yeah, he joined a gang before he reached the age of 10. Imagine that. So by the time he was 11, he even had a method of killing an elephant. He used to shoot the elephant straight in its forehead, killing it instantly.
Dude, no. Just no.
Yeah, so this gets worse. He had a weird sort of explanation about how his killing elephants was an act of charity.
Oh, pray tell me, please. I want to see where this, like, I want to see how his brain works. Tell me.
Yeah, so it's an act of charity because millions of living beings like birds and ants will eat the carcass and sustain themselves on a single elephant carcass.
That is the biggest load of elephant dung I have heard on Khuni and in my life. So yeah. Like, it's probably some kind of weird justification and an attempt to portray himself as some kind of like Robin Hood, I suppose. Which is I think his MO going forward.
Yeah.
Okay. Foreshadowing people. So at this point, we can't say anything, but it is quite evident that he was very popular among the village crowd. So there was a reason why so many people joined Veerappan, okay? The local granite mines were closed and many people were left unemployed. So he had a large pool of people to recruit from. He had couriers, guides, lookouts, cooks, cleaners, etc. He also had a special team consisting of locals for sandalwood cutting and smuggling from villages along the Tamil Nadu-Karnataka border around the Palar River. So he had a very large smuggling operation. He paid daily wages, and this was literally the only source of livelihood for the villagers. Thanks to Veerappan, villagers saw 20 rupee notes for the first time in their lives. It's a big deal. Soon he branched out into poaching as well. But he had a problem. There was a rival gang operating in the same area.
Dude, listen, competition should be encouraged, okay? It keeps the quality of goods and services high. This is what I learned in economics.
No, bro, not according to Veerappan. So he invited all the members of this rival gang for lunch, and he said that he wanted to discuss marking out areas in which they will operate and in which he will operate.
Oh, no. This does not sound right. There are so many red flags in that one sentence.
Yeah, alas. I wish the gang had the same level of foresight or your gut feeling, because they went to the luncheon. Veerappan discussed marking out the areas and they were ready to leave. when he offered them paan. Paan is like a mouth freshener in India. Okay, so that was a signal for the men hiding in the forest to open fire. He wiped out the entire rival gang in one afternoon.
Wow, I can hear the Godfather music playing in the background. Like, yeah. Wow, I'm still processing this. Also, didn't thuggies used to do something like this? Dude, you did the shorty, right? Like, they would befriend their intended victims and then give them paan and then strangle them.
I don't remember the paan details specifically, but yes, they would become friendly with these moving caravans and gain their trust and ultimately garrote them, basically, and they would kill. Yeah. Okay, so after all this, all the other gangs in the area either disbanded or the members joined Veerappan's poaching / smuggling operation. Veerappan was a tough
taskmaster. These are smart people. These are smart people.
Yeah, or people with very few options in life either.
Yeah.
So Veerappan was a tough taskmaster. He was feared and he knew that he was feared. In fact, he helped cultivate his own larger-than-life image. He had one pet peeve, police informers, alleged or real ones. So even with the slightest doubt, he used to shoot anybody who was suspected of being one. So as you can see, people really feared him and basically did everything he wanted. So until 1986, he generally managed to remain under the radar of the police. But in 1986, this kind of fell apart and Veerappan was arrested. And this is how this happened. So Veerappan went to Bangalore to buy ammunition. He ended up in a quarrel with the dealer and this guy went and informed the police. Now, under any normal circumstances, the police would have taken their own sweet time investigating this. But sadly for Veerappan, the SAARC summit was being held in Bangalore and the police wanted to round up all antisocial elements, so they tracked him down and arrested him. After this arrest, he was produced before the Deputy Conservator of Forests, P. Srinivas. Srinivas was a seasoned cop and he immediately knew that he had caught a big fish. He commenced his investigation into Veerappan, but this did not last long. One day, he took Veerappan into a guest house deep inside the Bodhi Padaga forest and he left him in the care of his two deputies. Veerappan knew he had a chance to escape. He coaxed the guards into giving him some oil, saying that he had headache, and when the guards were asleep, he put that oil in his hands, slipped off the handcuff and took off into the night.
Dude, again, who trains police in India? Like, who?
I think I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to the policeman here. I mean, he did have his hands cuffed. The only thing these policemen did was give him oil for his headache. Like, they took mercy on him. You know, that's all their fault was, I think. I don't think they even realized that they were dealing with a person who had the ability to lubricate his hands and take his handcuffs off. I don't think they knew that they were dealing with an ingenious person like that.
Very smart.
Yeah. So this escape was only investigated when the Supreme Court questioned these events literally 14 years later in the Raj Kumar kidnapping case.
Dude. Honestly, I don't believe this. See, it's possible that Veerappan bribed or threatened his way out also. Because as we know, the official version is not always the real version.
Yeah, could be. And his fingerprints were also not taken in this case. Now, remember how I said that the granite quarries were shut down in the area? They shut down because of Veerappan only. He was the one who used to extort money from the mine owners and then force them to pass explosives on to him, which is why the Karnataka government banned them. This led to loss of jobs, which led to more people joining Veerappan's operations. This guy is all big picture.
Yeah. Like, he, everything fits. Like, all the, like, I'm sure, like, you know, if Veerappan went to a B school and gave, like, a lecture, there'll be at least 10 or 11 people who'll come out as successful entrepreneurs after that.
Yeah.
Like, how blocks fall into places and all that. So, the government finally started noticing Veerappan when in April 1990, he ambushed a jeep carrying 10 policemen, leaving 3 sub-inspectors dead. Adding to all this, there were more and more rumors spreading about him. Some said he popped up in Kaziranga also, in Assam. They said he was found in Kaziranga.
Yeah.
Myth, insane. The man, the legend.
Yep.
So, then finally, on 16th April 1990, the then Karnataka Chief Minister Virendra Patil announced the creating of a special task force to catch Veerappan. Remember Srinivas, that cop who first looked at Veerappan? He joined this STF voluntarily. So he set up camp outside Veerappan's village. He worked really hard. He wanted to gain the villagers' trust and finally get their help to nab Veerappan. It is said that he even set up a temple and a dispensary in Gopinatham. You know the most interesting part?
Tell me.
So he was always in constant contact with Veerappan's younger brother, Arjunan. Now, Arjunan was the exact antithesis of Veerappan. Okay, he was an alcoholic, chain smoker, and also a womanizer. Apparently, Veerappan would always yell at him saying that these would be his downfall.
When you said Arjunan was the antithesis of Veerappan, I imagined that he was this straight-laced village school teacher type person. I didn't anticipate the direction you were taking.
No, the thing is, I'll tell you why. Okay, so Veerappan apparently he gave up smoking and drinking and womanizing because, remember, I said he was caught in Bangalore. So he caught in a place where he was drinking, apparently. So he thought lower his senses and make him more vulnerable.
See, that's smart.
Exactly, dude. This guy is like super focused. Anyway, so Srinivas was hoping that someday he could use Arjunan to nab Veerappan. And turns out Srinivas was also friends with Veerappan's younger sister, Mariammal. Now, she was a well-liked woman in the village and apparently even volunteered at that dispensary that Srinivas had set up. But, you know, her story is kind of sad. So, one day, the special task force members picked up Mari, saying that, you know, she helped her sister-in-law, Veerappan's wife, Muthulakshmi, escape from house arrest and then join Veerappan in the forest. But then they could not find anything and let her go. So it is said that they abused her and threatened her. So she went to Srinivas's house and he apparently could not offer her any help. Then the next day Srinivas went to meet an informer in another village close by. And then on his arrival back to the village, he came to know that Mari killed herself by consuming pesticide.
Okay, look, something does not seem very kosher to me. I really want to know why the STF did not inform Srinivas that they were taking Mari for questioning. I mean, it's just too convenient that he had to go to, quote-unquote, meet an informer.
So the thing is, I would normally say, you know, stop being paranoid, stop smelling conspiracies where they don't exist. But what Aditi is saying is also like, kind of foreshadowing what we will talk about the STF in like maybe the second or the third episode. But Veerappan was also not convinced about this. Okay, he also smelled there was something wrong. So he was convinced that Srinivas was to blame for his sister's death. He felt that Srinivas only got Mari's support for the sole purpose of getting back at him. And that was not all. Srinivas had a raid into one of Veerappan's hideouts and confiscated 800 kgs of sandalwood. But what annoyed Veerappan the most was that 20 of his men surrendered. And these 20 men told the police all of Veerappan's plans. Veerappan saw red when he came to know of this. And what he planned next is pretty diabolical. So one day, Arjunan went to Srinivas and said, Anna wants to surrender and he wants you to come. He wants you to walk towards Namdali and he will meet you halfway.
Okay, like that's not suspicious at all. Again, maybe we need to talk to your police friend once, like off the record, and ask him who trains policemen.
Yes, one day, soon, there'll be a Zoom call between the three of us, Aditi. Don't worry, off the record. Because I want my friend uninjured and safe. Right. So a few days passed and Veerappan messaged. Srinivas could not contain his excitement. He immediately left for the meeting spot. Arjunan and a few villagers accompanied him. While they were walking, Srinivas did not notice that the villagers began to slip away one by one. A few minutes later, Srinivas realized that he was alone. He did not realize that he was walking into a trap until it was too late. Arjunan and Srinivas reached a muddy pool. Veerappan and a few men stepped out of the bushes. Even at this point, Srinivas thought Veerappan came to surrender. Then reality hit him like a bucket of cold water. Veerappan and his men began to laugh. Srinivas froze, and in that second, Veerappan fired his rifle at him. He fired till Srinivas was dead. Then, Veerappan chopped off Srinivas's head and carried this back to his village. And once in the village, him and his comrades played football with it.
Oh my God, that is so messed up.
Yeah, that happened. And this was a message, okay? A message to the STF to not fuck with him. And dude, if you thought this was cold as fuck, let me tell you something even colder.
Colder than this, you mean?
Yep. Okay, so for this, we need to know a little bit more about Veerappan's family life. So remember, I told you that he said he will not womanize and all that?
Yeah, yeah.
So, despite all of that, all of his, you know, pledges to himself, he fell in love with Muthulakshmi. Veerappan's moustache, his gaze, and his air of authority attracted her as well, and she returned his affections. But her parents were not too happy with Veerappan's suit. Her father categorically told him that Muthulakshmi's marriage was already fixed with one of her cousins. A few months passed and these two eloped. They got married in a temple in a forest.
So filmy, dude.
Yeah, exactly. So a few months later, Muthulakshmi gave birth to their first daughter, Vidyarani. But this was also kind of the abridged version, okay? The full story is that she managed to stay in the forests until she was 8 months pregnant. And then she finally returned to her parents' house for her delivery. But her dad was scared that, you know, she may be arrested. So he took her to Chennai and she surrendered to the police. The police put her up in a woman's hostel. There she gave birth to Vidyarani. In fact, Vidya was named by an STF officer.
Wow, okay.
Crazy, no?
Yeah.
So, the STF permitted Muthulakshmi to return to her parents' house, but they monitored her movements. Then Veerappan sent word asking Muthulakshmi to return to the forests. But Muthulakshmi did not want to leave Vidyarani. In fact, Veerappan asked her to leave the girl with her grandparents, but she didn't want to. But then, after, despite a lot of convincing, you know, a few weeks later, Muthulakshmi left and she left Vidyarani with her grandparents. So sometime in 1991, Veerappan also started venturing into kidnapping. His gang abducted the son of a granite quarry owner and demanded a ransom of 1 crore. And then later the ransom was negotiated down to 15 lakhs. What the hell? Dude, this is like bargaining Sarojini, man.
Oh, this is much better than Sarojini. I can never get this kind of a deal at Sarojini ever.
Anyway, so 2 years later, the couple had another baby girl, Prabha. Another year passed, another baby girl was born to them. But this third baby was sort of a concern to Veerappan. By now, his gang had over 100 members, including women, children and old people. One day, they were on the run from the STF. Their fortress in Bodamalai was surrounded from 3 sides. This forced this band of 100 odd people to move deeper into the forest. So now, in a forest, a baby's cry can go as high as 110 decibels. This is around 10 decibels less than a thunder clap. So, on top of all this, a baby's cry is like supremely unpredictable. So one day, while on the run, this baby girl let out a loud cry, alarming everyone. Veerappan turned towards his midwife, the same one that delivered this baby and Veerappan's second child, Prabha. She understood what he wanted. She gave the baby some juice of calotropis. The baby choked to death. The whole camp, including Veerappan, breathed a sigh of relief. Muthulakshmi was the only one who mourned for the loss of her baby. A few days later, the STF team found a fresh-looking mound near Marimaduvu. They dug it up and found the body of a baby.
Wait, one second. There was a secret code between Veerappan and the midwife about killing Veerappan's child. Seriously, like that was the level of planning he had done in his life.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes, like one look and that woman understood what had to be done.
She knew which look means kill this child. That's insane to me. Seriously, that is insane. This is cult-like behavior.
I don't know. It's just like his ultimate goal seemed to be like...
making money.
Yeah, making money. I mean, he was ready to do anything to do it.
Fucking sociopath. It's almost as if he had no feelings. Like, tactical considerations always outweighed ethical ones. I mean, he was ready to do anything to survive, I think.
In fact, you know, wow. If we had any sponsors, I would have gone on a commercial break right now. This is just too much to take in.
Yes, baby killing is where I draw the line. Okay. A few days after that, the telephone rang at the Ramapura police station. They said, quote, "Saibru, I have some information on Veerappan," said a timid voice on the other end. The policeman said, "Come to Kodali inspection bungalow tomorrow morning." And the next day, the two officers, Hari Krishna and Shakil Ahmed, went to meet the man on the phone. Oh, so here's an interesting factoid about Shakil Ahmed, the police officer. He promised that he would not marry until Veerappan was caught.
Face palm moment. Why do they do all this, police people?
So the informer was Nagraj, right? And he was a daily wage laborer who was carrying rations to Veerappan's hideout. The police questioned Nagraj till they were convinced that he was telling the truth and that he had in fact really met the outlaw. So another plan was hatched. Nagraj slowly gained the brigand's trust. One day he quietly told Veerappan about some brokers from Bangalore who wanted to buy ivory from Veerappan in exchange for arms. Veerappan was hooked and he delegated this mission to a man called Gurunathan. So posing as brokers, the two police informants met Gurunathan. He told them that the gang needed guns and bullets and they promised to arrange a meeting with an agent from Mumbai. So this quote-unquote agent arrived a few days later and this was actually Shakil Ahmed. On February 17, 1992, 35 policemen in Mufti along with Shakil and Hari Krishna set off for the designated meeting place. They sent word to Gurunathan to come, asking him to come to a spot a few kilometers away from the spot they had originally agreed. So they made the excuse that, these were people from Mumbai and they did not want to come into the trees, like they did not want to step into the forest. And once Gurunathan got to the spot where they asked him to come, they shot him dead. Again, Veerappan was furious. The police came very close to catching him. On 19th May 1992, Veerappan had his revenge. Veerappan and his comrades unleashed a rain of bullets on the Ramapura police station. He killed around 10 policemen that day. But he still did not manage to take revenge on Shakil Ahmed and Hari Krishna. And then came August 1992. This time, he tracked down a man who was another informant for the STF. This man's name was Naika. He went and told Shakil that Arjunan was camping nearby and he had about 40 kgs of tusks and he was looking for a buyer. Tusks is elephant teeth. So Naika told them that Arjunan asked him to come dressed in white and in a white car. Naika told the policeman to go ahead and said that he will follow them with his own people. And Shakil was really excited. He called Hari Krishna, who was in Bangalore for the day, and he told Shakil to postpone the operation for that day. The next day, on 14th August, these men set off. Hari Krishna and Shakil set off in the white ambassador car, and a lorry full of Mufti policemen followed them, keeping a 2-kilometer distance. Then on the way, they encountered this huge pile of rocks blocking the road. Nayaka came running to the ambassador. He seemed to be in a hurry to move the pile of rocks. Then Shakil noticed that there was a red scarf around Nayaka's neck. He was in white as well. And then it struck Shakil. This is a trap. Shit, this fucker trapped us. And then bullets started raining on them. Veerappan's men killed both Shakil and Hari Krishna that day.
So basically, Shakil died without getting married. Okay, the look on Aditi's face right now is hilarious, but like she's angry, angry hilarious. And as I said, I provide free comic relief.
Yeah, you guys need it. Believe it or not, you guys need the comic relief. Anyway, so there were 6 shotgun bullet wounds on Shakil's body, and Hari Krishna's body was riddled with bullet holes. Veerappan did not suffer even a single casualty. But Veerappan's biggest yet, almost a Quentin Tarantino-esque attack, was yet to come.
So, when you say Good Friday Massacre of 1993, it probably won't mean much to you and me. But to the STF, it was literally a black day. For this story, we first need to tell you about the story of Rambo Gopalakrishnan, who used to head a 42-man team called the Jungle Patrol. Following the murders of Shakil and Hari Krishna, this patrol was strengthened. So, Rambo, who was also built like Rambo in the movie Rambo, led his team from the front, okay? Like, his entire team loved him. He had this entire area under patrol and he knew it like the back of his hand. And his team loved him. He had a massive network of informers and guides. And usually, these are people who are sometimes, who worked for some time with Veerappan, or in fact, even then, like people who were associated with Veerappan. Now, on the morning of 9th April, which happened to be Good Friday that year, a huge banner was found in Kolathur village. The banner taunted Rambo in coarse Tamil and dared him to come catch Veerappan at a place called Surai Kamadavu. And Rambo fell for this. He summoned his team. Things don't seem right, said one of his advisors. But Rambo was stubborn. He said he was going no matter what.
My God, men and their egos. How can you be riled up by a banner, knowing what you know about this guy? Ugh, come on.
So as Rambo neared the Palar Bridge, the jeep carrying him and his men broke down. They abandoned the vehicle and borrowed 2 buses from the Karnataka policemen stationed at the bridge on the Tamil Nadu-Karnataka border. The first bus carrying 15 informers, 4 policemen and 2 forest watchers took the lead. The second bus carrying an inspector and 6 Tamil Nadu policemen plus an escort party from the Karnataka police followed. A restless and edgy Rambo stood near the front of the first bus. He had an AK-47 on his shoulder, his left hand gripping a steel bar behind his seat, ready to attack. Meanwhile, Veerappan was lazing on a rock overlooking a track next to the dry Palar River, the route for Rambo's motorcade. Meanwhile, his explosives expert, Simon, was making the final arrangements. Then they heard the rumble of bus engines and sighted the 2 buses, but not Rambo's jeep. They were kind of confused now. Then a whistle from Veerappan clarified their doubts. With his sharp marksman's eyes, Veerappan spotted the bulky form of Rambo. Simon joined the leads of a 12-volt car battery linked to the mines. Then it was almost as if Lucifer rained down on Earth. The earth beneath the buses erupted like a volcano in Pompeii. Shockwaves spread and threw the buses into the air. Rambo's bus bore the brunt of the impact. The rubble and stone thrown upwards at speeds of over 1,000 kilometers per hour came crashing down to earth in a mix of mud, metal and burnt body parts. Rambo was ejected out of the vehicle and fell into a nearby ditch with severe injuries on his left leg, left hand and face. Mangled body parts of other people rained down on bushes and rocks alongside the road. So pieces of flesh got stuck on the branches of nearby trees. The first bus literally became a steel coffin. Pieces of its chassis lay scattered all over. There was the smell of melted rubber mixed with burnt flesh in the air. In some parts, there were ripped parts of steel which were mixed with bloody body parts. Wow. Aditi, thoughts?
I'm just imagining the carnage, Baba. This is like from a horror movie. This is horrible.
Totally. Like, you know, some say that even Veerappan was stunned by the sight. But then the remaining jungle patrol started firing shots. Remember the policemen in the second bus? Their bus had to stop because the windscreen was splattered with blood and body parts. Inspector Ashok Kumar ordered his men to get down from the bus and to start firing indiscriminately. Bullets were exchanged from both sides for a while. After that, the gang tried to outflank the surviving policemen. And after a few painful moments of firing, the gang finally stopped firing and they slowly took off from there. They fled. Ashok Kumar surveyed the surroundings. 14 pits were dug in a row, 10 feet apart each. They had been filled with explosives connected by a long stretch of fuse wire. All this was concealed with stones and mud. The wire had been drawn at a distance of some 200 feet up a rocky hill where the gang lay in wait for Rambo. Then Ashok Kumar realized that Rambo was alive. Incredibly, this man survived being in a bus that was blown to bits. Dude, this guy's like real life Rambo.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So this Good Friday blast sent shockwaves through both the states of Karnataka and Tamil Nadu. Veerappan was catapulted into criminal celebrityhood. The price on his head was now 20 lakh rupees, which is a lot for back then.
Yeah.
So Rambo was sent to a hospital in Chennai. He woke up to see CM Jayalalitha was by his bedside. After she met him, Jayalalitha decided that this was gone on for too long. She set up a few meetings with Karnataka CM M. Veerappa Moily. After this, the Tamil Nadu STF formally came into being. This was headed by Walter Davaram. He only picked the best of the best for his task force. But out of all of this Good Friday massacre, one good thing had come. The team managed to capture the weapons expert, Simon.
Then on 21st May, the STF team received information about Veerappan's den. They decided to attack in the dark. They had with them the informer who told them about this den. So the man led them to a sort of tunnel through some dense bushes. After a few minutes of intense crawling, the team reached a small clearing. They tried to hide out there, but there were no bushes. So they clung together, trying for a target as small as possible. And they lay quietly for a minute. The moon disappeared behind the clouds. The men were in pitch darkness and it was deathly quiet. Too dark to even make a hand signal. There was a structure in the middle of the clearing. The team slowly inched their way towards it. It was a well. There were rations, remains of food, torn clothes, and ashes near the well. The team were a few days late. Veerappan's team had already left. Next, we are going to talk about a very dramatic staged attack by Veerappan. In fact, there are multiple accounts of this, but we tried to get a neutral perspective of the same. So it was May 1993, the forests were hot. Veerappan's courier, Punnu Swami, was restless. He tried to get away from Govindam without being stopped, but alas, he was spotted. Setukuli Govindam, he was the latest rising star in Veerappan's gang. He asked Punnu Swami, "Where are you going?" He was also Veerappan's distant cousin, and he stared at Punnu Swami menacingly. And Punnu Swami crumbled and confessed. Govindan dragged Punnu Swami to Veerappan and he confessed that the STF had told him to break into the camp and assassinate Veerappan. Obviously, Veerappan was furious and he started planning. 24th May 1993 was a beautiful day in MM Hills, around 150 kilometers from Mysore. The road to Mysore has many, many S-curves and is full of greenery. Veerappan lay on a hillock, waiting for his prey. The Karnataka STF convoy was expected any moment. His men were watching the STF camp. They knew the movements in and out. It was around 7 a.m. when he picked up the sound of the approaching vehicles. He tensed. He nodded to his aides. Soon, three police jeeps came into view. Veerappan concentrated on the middle one, which was carrying Gopal Hosur, who was the STF policeman who commanded the camp in MM Hills. He was an irritating insect. Just like an insect, he had to be crushed to death under a boot. He gave the signal to get into the position of shooting. But before he could give the signal, one idiot just shot. Boom. But despite this screw-up, the convoy was riddled with bullets. STF men were hit even before they could understand what was happening. But then Gopal escaped and Veerappan shouted, "I will get you one day." So Gopal was taken to a hospital in Salem and then he was shifted to Bangalore. He fought against death for months, but eventually survived.
Right. So next we move to September 1993. Now the place is Asansur police station and the stray dogs around the camp began barking. A ragged man approached a sentry and asked to meet Inspector Mohan Nawaz. The sentry shooed him away. The man persisted. Next day when Nawaz entered the camp, the man tried to approach him again, but the sentry tried to shoo this man away again. This time Nawaz looked at him and said, "Wait, I know him." This man was Jadeyan, the headman of Gaddesal, a village largely inhabited by members of the Sholiga tribe. Nothing happened in the area without his knowledge. The man told Nawaz that boys from his village saw a lot of, then he sort of like seemed to be very reluctant to see what they saw. "Of what, man?" said Nawaz. "Of shit, sir, human excreta." Nawaz made a face. The man continued, "Not our people, strangers, rice eaters. The stool is yellowish, not brown. I sent some more people. They saw thatched sheds and a lot of people, including children. Must be the ones you're looking for." Wow. So this strange shit theory made a lot of sense to Nawaz. So the logic is the locals ate ragi and grains. Basically a diet which made the stool dark. And a lot of our listeners who have eaten ragi at some point in their lives will attest to this. Sorry for making shit jokes.
Yep, right here.
Yeah, so who the people Jadeyan was talking about were definitely not locals. The only question that remained with Nawaz is, who were they? Were they Veerappan's gang? And he promised that he'll check it out. The next day morning, the STF team went to check this place out. Their scout managed to locate the camp deep in the forest, hidden by chest-high Genagu grass. There were a dozen or so huts. Women were doing their chores and children played in the clearing, and men were either cutting grass logs or were cleaning rifles. The police were wondering what to do about the situation when a barking deer barked and a surprised policeman dropped the aluminum utensil that carried the police's food. Abe! Okay, so obviously pandemonium erupted. The police had lost their element of surprise again. Everyone in the camp ran in every direction. At that time, there were only the foot soldiers, women and children, and hence there was no leadership. So that day, Veerappan's brother Arjunan was in the camp. He took his sister-in-law and ran, but she got separated from him. The next day, the police arrested The next day, she was arrested. This raid had a great effect on Veerappan. His gang was scattered. People took off, never to return. He not only lost his wife, but also two of his closest aides. Within days, the two men were dead. They were killed in encounters by the Karnataka STF that had apparently crossed into Tamil Nadu.
So this also created a wedge between Tamil Nadu STF and Karnataka STF. And in the meantime, Veerappan's gang had gotten smaller. He started venturing into kidnapping again. His gang kidnapped wildlife photographers Senani and Krupakar. He meant to kidnap a forest official, but his gang members kidnapped these two men, you know, but they were released subsequently. So in 1998, he kidnapped a Professor Krishnaswamy. He kidnapped the editor of Neetikan, A.S. Mani. He kidnapped a reporter, Payumpuli, and a photographer, Richard Mohan. They were all freed by the STF later. But all these seem to be like practice runs for the main kidnapping. The one kidnapping that was going to send Karnataka into a tizzy. And that is where we stop. This is the first episode of the Veerappan series.
Yeah, guys, let us know how you like it. In fact, the next episode, we're going to look at the kidnapping and a couple of other things. So in the meanwhile, please follow us on Spotify or wherever you can follow us. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate us and review us. It'll help a lot of new listeners find us. And we had a great time answering your AMAs this weekend. So any clarifications you have regarding this episode, let us know. Yeah, so have a great week. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.